store, then at a bookshop. For 6 months, he worked in one of the ministries, but once that finished, even temporary work dried up. Then he was injured. The injury to his lower left leg was caused by an explosive bullet, Moa said. The butterfly bullet that was deployed by the Zionist regime military during the demonstrations. Part of the bone in the leg shattered, and both an artery and a vein were damaged. He underwent 8 operations, including 4, for a bacterial infection in the wound, and has needed painkillers ever since. He has trouble walking, needs crutches for support, and staying on his feet for any length of time makes the pain recur. The injury has had a dramatic effect on a man who used to love playing volleyball in the evenings on Gaza's beach. Instead of his previous incessant drive to find work and enjoy his downtime, Moaz is now depressed, without energy, and dominated by negative thoughts. No time is worse than the summer. Moaz said, "My injury feels worse. The heat is unbearable. The mosquitoes are everywhere. I hate the season." He said, "Everything about the summer makes me feel worse, and I used to love the summer." Doctors have told him that he is unable to do hard physical labor, the most readily available work in Gaza, and he has lost any drive to seek other employment. Moaz is not alone. The brutal Israeli regime response to the Great March of Return protest caused tens of thousands of injuries. Among the injured from the Great March of Return protest, 158 needed amputations, 124 of their lower limbs. 4 had upper limbs amputated, and 30 patients had fingers and toes amputated. According to Ayman Abu Obeid, head of the surgery department at Nasser Hospital in the city of Khan Yunis, the amputations were often caused by subsequent bacterial infections of the type Moaz contracted. According to the Ministry of Health in Gaza, some 600 of those wounded in the return marches had repeated infections due to germs resistant to treatment. A report from Doctors Without Borders, MSF, at the end of 2018 found that many of the injured in the protest had infections that prevent healing, a situation compounded by Gaza's lack of adequate medical tools to diagnose bone infections. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported out of 1,851 permit applications for patients from the Gaza Strip to get Israeli regime permission to leave the besieged sea enclave through Beit Hanun Erez crossing for treatment in the West Bank, East Al-Quds, or Israeli regime hospitals, 1,492 or 81% of the total applications were approved in July. And of the 8,678 West Bank patient applications in July for medical treatment in East Al-Quds or Israeli regime hospitals, 6,477 or 75% were approved, 7% lower than the average approval rate in 2022, according to the World Health Organization's monthly health access report on barriers for patients in the occupied Palestinian territory. Out of a further 112 permit applications for Gaza patients and companions were submitted through the Palestinian General Authority of Civil Affairs during July for travel by shuttle to Jordan, which requires approval of Zionist and Jordanian authorities for direct transfer from Beit Hanun Erez to the King Hussein Bridge to Jordan without formal entry to occupied territories or the West Bank. 6 or 5% were approved within the month, none were denied, and 106 or 95% remained pending at the time of monthly reporting. Of the Gaza Strip applications, more than a quarter, 27%, for children under 18 and a fifth were for patients over 60 years old. In addition, 47% of applications were for appointments in East Al-Quds hospitals. 36% were hospitals in the West Bank outside East Al-Quds and 17% for Israeli regime hospitals. The top five specialists accounted for 73% of permit applications. Oncology, 36%. Hematology, 11%. Cardiology, 10%. And pediatrics, 8%.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ard.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام وقال عليه السلام في قوله تعالى إن الله يأمر بالعدل والإحسان العدل الإنصاف والإحسان التفضل
Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali alayhi salam, said about Allah saying in the Quran, chapter 16, verse 90, Verily, Allah enjoins justice, adl, and benevolence, ihsan. Here, adl means equidistribution, and ihsan means favor.
و Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, one of the beautiful attributes and qualities that we find in the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is the attribute of honesty. Now, of course, this is one of the fundamental aspects of Imam Ali alayhi salam's universal persona. And of course, we have said in many of our programs that the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam is in reality the fruit of the teachings and the message of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam Ali alayhi salam is the living, breathing miracle of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi. Of course, honesty is a fundamental pillar in Islam. Telling the truth, being honest in our dealings, being just in our dealings, all of these things go hand in hand. And we find in the persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam that honesty in all of affairs of life is something that is witnessed clearly in Imam Ali alayhi salam. Whether he is honest and he is truthful with his friends, his companions, his family members, or whether he is honest and truthful with those people that are under him, those people that work in his fields, those people who work for him, or whether he is even honest and truthful even with the enemy, we do not find that Imam Ali alayhi salam deceived the enemy, or that he did something to be able to, be dishonest or to be unjust even against the enemy. And really, honesty is something that we can really use in the present day and in this world. Is not one of the things that is fundamentally lacking in the world is honesty. Honesty, of course, is this virtue which has so many different branches and is connected to so many different virtues. Sincerity, fairness, equity, being just, truthful, honesty, all of these things go hand in hand. If sincerity breaks down, so do these others. If honesty breaks down, so do these others. If justice breaks down, so do these other virtues break down. They're all connected to one another. And so we must try in our lives to try to be honest, especially in our dealings, in our affairs, whether it is at work or at home or it is at school. Honesty is really the best policy, and we learn that from Imam Ali alayhi salam. If people were honest and sincere and truthful and just in their behaviors, in their interactions with one another, with themselves, then the world would be a much, much better place. And yes, we have to be honest with ourselves. Sometimes we ourselves confuse ourselves, we are dishonest with ourselves, and a lot of the mistakes and errors that we make come about precisely because we are not honest with ourselves. We do not look within ourselves and see the things that are wrong with us, but unfortunately, we are so quick to pick out and see the things that are wrong with others. A beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and it's an honor to be invited by Brother Mahdi to this program. Today we're going to listen to George Jordak, who's going to talk about Imam Ali, alayhi salam, and also about his book, Ali, The Voice of Human Justice. Let's listen to it.
أخوتي الأخ الأكبر اللي هو فؤاد كان عالم لغوي وكان عالم رياضي وكان شاعر وخطيب
وهو اللي The name of my older brother was Fuad. He was a poet, a philologist, and also a mathematician. For the first time, this was Fuad who attracted me towards reading Nahj al-Balagha. One day, my older brother Fuad brought me a volume of the book Nahj al-Balagha and asked me to read it before starting to read any other book. He asked me to read it and memorize it. I too started reading Nahj al-Balagha and memorizing some parts of it.
وبعدين أخي فؤاد كان عنده قصائد كثيرة في مدح الإمام علي شخصيته.
My brother Fuad compiled many poems about Imam Ali, his character, and his personal merits and blessings. When there was a gathering of elites and scholars in our house, Fuad used to read parts of his poems about Imam Ali for them, and they listened to his poems eagerly. In general, the poems of my brother, the stone cutting of my father on the top of our house door, written, "There is no master like Ali, and there is no sword like Zulfiqar," and of course, Nahj al-Balagha, all guided me towards Imam Ali.
Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi talks about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
I just would like to share with you one sentiment or the feeling of a lady who was among the followers of Ahlul Bayt. And this is a lady who is known as Sauda bint Ammara bin al-Ashtar al-Hamdaniya. And she was from the family which believed in Amir al-Mu'mineen, from the Hamdaniya Yemeni family and the tribe. And she was a poetess in her own right. She was talented in composing poetry. Very, very powerful words where she says, صَلَّ الْإِلَهَ عَلَىٰ رُوحٍ فَضَمَّنُهُ قَبْرٌ فَأَصْبَحَ فِيهِ الْعَدْلُ مَدْفُونَ. May Allah shower His salawat and blessings on the soul, تَضَمَّنُهُ قَبْرٌ, when the grave took him in, فَعَصْبَحَ فِيهِ الْعَدْلُ مَدْفُونَ. It was not Ali who was buried in there, it was Adl which was buried with him. Means when Ali went, justice is gone. This is what we get from people like you. And so Muawiyah says, "How? What do you know about the justice of Ali?" And she says, "I'm actually remembering the day where I went to him with a similar complaint like I've come here today. And I went inside, he was doing his Nafila prayers. He sensed I was there, he shortened his prayers, turned to me and he said, 'You know, what is your hajat? Why have you come here?' And when I presented the case of his revenue officer, who was being, you know, harsh than required, in his dealing with the issue of, you know, taking revenue for the government, Amir al-Mu'mineen, according to her, he cried at that time on the musalla, raised his hands and says, 'Allahumma inni lam amur bi dhulmi khalqik. O Allah, you be witness. I did not ask my officers to be unjust to the people. If someone from my officer has done this, it's not because I have asked them to do this.' And he immediately asked for the the paper and pen, and he wrote a letter to this person, instructing him to come back as soon as he gets the letter, so that he can then, present his own side of the story.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Like dominoes, African states are one by one falling outside the shackles of neo-colonialism. Chad, Guinea, Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, and now Gabon are saying no to France's long-time domination of African financial, political, economic, and security affairs. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV noted, Berlin Conference of 1884 to 1885 was undeniably one of the biggest evil summits in modern history. Greedy and racist European colonialists sat down in the German city and divided Africans as if they were sharing bread on a breakfast table. The conference was organized by Otto von Bismarck, the first Chancellor of Germany, at the request of King Leopold II of Belgium, the Western genocidal barbarian that murdered more than 10 million innocent Africans in Congo. Most Africans are now even aware of this genocide in Congo, perpetrated by the Belgian colonialists, because it is not in the history books written by the white colonialists. European colonialism in Africa lasted more than a century, with only the ancient kingdom of Ethiopia spared because they defeated the Italian colonialists on the battlefield. Trillions and trillions of dollars were stolen from Africa. Millions of Africans were murdered by the European colonialists. And Africans were massively brainwashed that they had no history before European colonialism. The wave of independence in Africa from 1950s and 1960s did not represent true independence. What actually happened was that colonialism was cleverly replaced with neo-colonialism by the genocidal imperialist barbarians of the West. The massive looting of rich resources in Africa continued under Western puppet leadership. The courageous African leaders who refused to dance to the tune of the European colonialists were eliminated. This was what happened to African heroes Patrick Lumumba of Congo and Thomas Sankara of Burkina Faso. Congo has all mineral resources except for crude oil. The uranium used by the US regime to make the atomic bombs unleashed on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was mined in Congo. Among the European colonialists, French colonialism was more brutal and exploitative. France killed more than 1.5 million civilians in Algeria alone. They murdered tens of thousands of civilians in other African countries. One of the modus operandi of the French colonialists was to assemble Islamic scholars in a hall and exterminate all of them. They did this in Algeria, Chad, Mali, and Senegal. And the greed of their neocolonialism is extreme. Even after independence, France is still controlling the wealth of its former colonies in Africa. The rich resources of French nations are still controlled by France, and they continue to pay colonial tax to France. French goods and services dominate their markets. The domineering presence of France in these countries has been excruciating and devastating for the local populations. Niger Republic does not know the quantity of uranium France was taking from there, which is worse than slavery. There is a popular saying that no evil lasts forever. France's neocolonialism in Africa will not last forever. Popular military coups against puppets of France's imperialism have started and are gathering momentum. The recent military coup in the West African state of Niger Republic does not stand in isolation but follows similar upheavals in the neighboring countries of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Guinea in recent years. Mali is facing insurgency that is backed by Western hegemony. Mali expelled French troops because they were actively aiding the insurgents to justify its military presence in the African country. Now, we woke up with the news of another puppet of the Western hegemonic barbarians in Gabon overthrown by the military. Ali Bongo inherited the Gabon presidency from his corrupt father, Omar Bongo. Recently, some military personnel appeared on state TV and announced that they were seizing power and dislodging a family that has ruled the country for 56 years. The military officers introduced themselves as members of the Committee of Transition and the Restoration of Institutions. Today, the country is undergoing a severe institutional, political, economic, and social crisis. The officer said in a statement, dubbing the recent election illegitimate, adding, "In the name of the Gabonese people, we have decided to defend the peace by putting an end to the current regime." Pertinently, Gabon's former president had 70 bank accounts, 39 apartments, 2 Ferraris, 6 Mercedes-Benz cars, three Porsche and Bugatti in France. He ruled for 42 years, from 1967 to 2009. French leaders loved Bongo because he was loyal to them. His son, Ali Bongo, has been the president for 14 years. He just has been overthrown in a coup. The fact is that the Western liberal democracy has not only failed in Africa, but has failed woefully. Democracy in Africa has become a tool for the corrupt ruling elites to steal the wealth of their respective countries and transfer it to Western financial institutions, while the populations remain in abject poverty and hunger. Democracy is just another system of government hijacked by the Western hegemonic barbarians, the biggest enemies of the human race. Democracy is now an imperialist tool of Western hegemony in Africa. This is a bitter and undeniable fact. The people of Gabon will definitely celebrate this military coup as it marks the end of French interference and looting in their country. Another setback for the French leaders. The most noticeable current in Mali, Burkina Faso, Guinea, Niger, Republic and Gabon is that the change of governments all have popular support as the people of those countries are tired of France's imperialism, arrogance and terrorism. Today, France has the fourth largest gold reserves in the world and there is no single gold mine in France. These gold mines are all in Mali, Niger Republic, and other African countries. The France neocolonialism in Africa must end. Its time has come. The website of the Cradle also wrote in this regard, by adding two new African member states to its roster, the recent summit in Johannesburg, heralding the expanded BRICS 11, showed once again that Eurasian integration is inextricably linked to the integration of Afro-Eurasia. Belarus is now proposing to hold a joint summit between BRICS 11, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and the Eurasia Economic Union. President Alexander Lukashenko's vision for the convergence of these multilateral organizations may, in due time, lead to the mother of all multipolarity summits. But Afro-Eurasia is a much more complicated proposition. Africa still lags far behind its Eurasian cousins on the road toward breaking the shackles of neocolonialism. The continent today faces horrendous odds in its fight against the deeply entrenched financial and political institutions of colonization, especially when it comes to smashing French monetary hegemony in the form of the franc CFA or the Communique France-Africaine or African Financial Community. Still, one domino is falling after another. Chad, Guinea, Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, and now Gabon. This process has already turned Burkina Faso's president, Captain Ibrahim Traoré, into a new hero of the multipolar world. As a dazed and confused collective, West can't even begin to comprehend the blowback represented by its eight coups in West and Central Africa in less than 3 years.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, feeding the needy and our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here in your presence and at your service Dear listeners, we are talking about helping and feeding the needy when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle. So now, of course, one of these very important things that Islam teaches us and that we need to do if we want to live a Islamic lifestyle, of course, is to feed the needy. Now, the reason I brought up feed the needy is because in the traditions, we find that this is the way that it is referred to. It says that one needs to feed the needy. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that we go find somebody who is in need and we take a bowl of rice and we feed them. Now, of course, in certain places and in certain situations, that is kind of what is being done. So you'll find food kitchens, or you'll find, you know, public services that go and they give food to people so that they can eat. Yeah, this is one way of helping a needy person or feeding a needy person, to actually physically find a way to give them food. But, you know, helping the needy is what is being referred to. And of course, as we said, this is one of the fundamental teachings in Islam. And if we want to live a Islamic lifestyle, then we need to be able to, you know, put it in our hearts. We need to be able to make it easy to help the needy. So what am I trying to say? Well, sometimes what happens is when our heart becomes hard, or, you know, for whatever reason, we start to move away from a Islamic lifestyle, well, we stop helping people that are needy. And matter of fact, we avoid helping people that are needy. Now, again, these are people that are truly in need. There's a lot of people who say they're in need, you know, but they have more wealth than, you know, the person giving them money, right? No, we're talking about people that are truly in need. And unfortunately, we kind of get into this behavior or into this, you know, in this kind of a hole or this kind of a well, where we stop wanting to help needy people. And that's what I was saying is very dangerous. We have to inculcate in ourselves the motivation and the drive to help people that are in need. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about feeding the needy and how it's a part of our Islamic lifestyle. And, of course, so we were going to talk about this, and that is that there's different ways of helping people that are in need. One way is to physically give them food, you know, which can be convenient, but at the same time, it can't be that easy to do. But you can financially help people that are in need. You know, you can give them money on a regular basis if you can, and help people to get back up on their feet. Now, that's another thing that needs to be taken into consideration. When we're helping people that are needy, we are helping people that are poor, we are helping people that are downtrodden, we don't want to make them dependent upon us. We want to find a way to get them back up on their feet, you know, and help them in the meantime until they are able to support themselves. That is ideally what is trying to be done. But sometimes people, they kind of fall into this trap where they really can't help themselves, you know, at that point in time. And, you know, we as a ummah, as a community, as a society, a Muslim society, trying to live a Islamic lifestyle, you know, it is our responsibility to help that individual or those individuals to get back up on their feet. You know, they kind of need that helping hand so that, you know, they are, again, back up on their feet and they're able to support themselves. But there's also other ways of helping. So, for example, let's say we don't have the financial means, and be careful, because sometimes we convince ourselves and make excuses that we don't have the financial means when we really do. But let's say, you know, sincerely, we don't have the financial means,
We can help them with our position or our status in society, or we can help them find a job, or we can give them a job, right? Or, for example, in the least, if we can't do anything, and sincerely we can't do anything, well, we can at least give encouragement. We can give them du'as and pray for them, you know, and give them a smile and at least make them, you know, emotionally and spiritually feel better. And again, this helping the people in need, a very fundamental aspect of living a Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In Britain, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has acknowledged that hundreds of schools in England are suffering from crumbling concrete. The Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has been accused of failure to fund a programme to replace ageing classrooms. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Irish Times has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Education Minister warned on Monday that hundreds more school buildings in England might be crumbling and unsafe for pupils after authorities announced more than 150 British schools are at risk of collapse. Britain's Secretary of State for Education, Gillian Keegan, said the government was still waiting on responses from around 10% of the 15,000 schools in England that were sent surveys to identify those at risk. This comes after authorities ordered 104 schools to shut buildings with old and weak concrete to close because of safety concerns. More than 150 schools have been found to contain buildings made from reinforced, autoclaved, aerated concrete, which has been assessed to be at risk of collapse after exceeding its 30-year lifespan. The lightweight form of reinforced, autoclaved, aerated concrete was widely used for walls, floors and ceilings during the 1960s through to 1980s, but now it is considered weak and unsafe for construction purposes. Gillian Keegan said schools that were suspected to have RAAC, that is reinforced, autoclaved, aerated concrete, would be inspected in the next 2 weeks. She told an interview with BBC, most of them won't have RAAC. It could be hundreds more. The British government has claimed the majority of the currently affected schools would still be able to operate largely normally. The revelations of crumbling school buildings just days before the start of a new term has sparked anger among parents and teachers and represents a new political headache for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's Conservative government. The crumbling school buildings issue has added to the impression of decaying public infrastructure in Britain. An official in the former government put the blame for the shortcomings in British schools on Rishi Sunak, who in his previous job as finance minister had halved annual funding to repair schools when the Education Department had asked for it to be doubled. Former Permanent Secretary Jonathan Slater told the BBC, "We were saying there is a critical risk to life if this programme is not funded properly. I was absolutely amazed to see the decision made by the government." The opposition Labour Party said the Conservative government has not taken repeated warnings about crumbling schools seriously. It charged Rishi Sunak with putting children's lives at risk by refusing to approve what needed to be spent to fix the problem. The scandals that Rishi Sunak's government has been facing its worst economic issues in decades. Also, British workers in various sectors, including transportation, healthcare and schools, are in dire economic straits. The workers have gone on repeated strikes over the past year because of low wages and rising cost of living crisis. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story. UK teachers suggested more British children are likely to arrive at school this term with unclean clothes and unbrushed teeth. According to an opinion poll, nearly 3 in 4 or 72% of school staff believe there has been an increase in hygiene poverty issues in their school over the past year. The survey of 500 school staff in the United Kingdom who had said they were aware of pupils experiencing hygiene poverty suggests that 71% expect the level of hygiene poverty to have increased at the start of the school year this month. Dirty school uniforms and PE kits, unwashed hair and unclean teeth were the most cited indicators of hygiene poverty by school staff questioned in June. The opinion poll carried out for charity The Hygiene Bank and cleaning brand Small defines hygiene poverty as those who are caught between being able to heat their home, pay their bills, buy food, or keep clean. Some of the school staff reported personally washing uniforms and PE kits for children at home and handing out laundry detergent for families in need. The survey, which was conducted by market research platform Attest, suggests that 72% of school staff said they had seen pupils affected by hygiene poverty experience low self-esteem. Meanwhile, 53% of school staff said their pupils were isolated or left out by other pupils in class, and 50% said they had seen a negative impact on mental health for those experiencing hygiene poverty. More than a quarter, or 26% of school staff said they had seen absenteeism as a result of hygiene poverty. One respondent said students are often left with no desk partner in class. Makes it awkward for staff members to deal with the situation. Students are often faced with working alone. Other students make nasty comments about them in front of the class to single them out. Other students make nasty comments about them in front of the class to single them out. Another respondent said they had a feeling of powerlessness, that they could not do more. Sarah Smith, executive head teacher of St Cuthbert's Catholic Academy, a primary school in Blackpool in northwest England, said, "We have seen an increase in students coming to school with unwashed uniforms, and we know that this has an effect on their mental health and overall well-being, which in turn will have a negative impact on their education." Brand Small, in collaboration with the Hygiene Bank, is hoping to expand its Suds in Schools initiative, which provides mini laundrettes to schools so more families in need are provided with clean clothes. Suds in Schools want to raise £25,000 to establish an additional 25 laundrettes in British schools. Lucy Wishart of Small said, "With hygiene poverty increasing, it's more important than ever for us to support more schools." She added, "We believe that everyone should have access to clean clothes in order to live their life to the fullest, and our research shows just how much this can impact young people at a crucial stage in their academic and social lives." Julie McCulloch, Director of Policy at the Association of School and College Leaders, said, hygiene poverty is linked to very high levels of deprivation as families struggle with the cost of things like washing machines, energy bills, and clothes. She said, many schools routinely help out by discreetly washing clothes and providing items of uniform. This has long been the case, but has become more of an issue following the pandemic and cost of living crisis as more families struggle financially. Julie McCulloch added, the level of child poverty in the United Kingdom is utterly unacceptable, and the government must do more to tackle the problem.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
In this episode, we invite you to English translation of a speech by Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, regarding Arba'in Walk as a divine phenomenon. Usually in such phenomena like Arba'in Walk, which has not been promoted in any way, by which suddenly emerges before one's eyes, the divine hand is more visible than in other phenomena. Notice how much effort in propaganda is made in the world in order to gather 10,000 or 50,000 individuals in one place. But in the end, they are unable to do so. In our country, despite the existence of many obstacles, 2 million people go to Karbala by way of an 80-kilometer walk. They walk, but they do not go there to enjoy themselves and to rest in a hotel. And a crowd of people several times larger than this goes to Karbala from within Iraq and from other countries. This is a divine event. This is a divine phenomenon. This shows that this path is the path of love. However, it is not a blind love. Rather, it is a kind of love that is marked by insight, such as the love the friends of God have for God. O God, feed me with your love, and the love of whomsoever loves you, and the love of all those actions that help me to get closer to you. Bahárul Anwar, Volume 91, page 149. This affection and this love is accompanied by insight. A person with such love knows and understands things, and this attraction and magnetic power pulls him.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The phenomenon of Arba'in is an indescribable, unprecedented phenomenon. This extraordinary movement is a great, astonishing demonstration. There is nothing like it in the world. Western powers cannot understand what this movement means. They cannot absorb it. That is why you have witnessed how they have remained silent since the beginning. They have hatched a plot of silence. While the Western powers and media expose every little move that takes place in the world, they have not mentioned this huge movement of the people for years. Only recently they have mentioned it a little, but their analyses were hostile and erroneous. From the viewpoint of the believers who walk on this path, their analyses were ridiculous. The likes of the English media and the other such media presented hostile analysis. This shows that the bubbling of this blessed spring has caused them to become extremely agitated. Thus, they are unable to analyze it. The significance of the first Arba'in lay in that it was the powerful voice of Ashura. From Ashura to Arba'in, when the household of the Prophet of Allah returned to Karbala, these 40 days were 40 days of the command of the logic of truth amidst the dark world of evil rulers and the Umayyad dynasty. The true voice was the outcry of Zainab al-Kubra and the outcry of Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam. But where? In Kufa and in the Levant, where complete darkness existed. These were the strongest voices. These were the voices that preserved Ashura. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Erdogan arrived in Sochi on the eve of the G20 summit. This was his first visit to Russia since his re-election in May. The Turkish official began the meeting with his Russian counterpart by expressing gratitude for Moscow's assistance in extinguishing forest fires and also efforts in eliminating the consequences of a powerful February earthquake. The two sides continued with the topic of the gas hub, which is also their common project. But it was clear that the topic of Ukraine and the grain deal were the main items on the agenda of Recep Tayyip Erdogan in the trip.
We are determined to continue efforts to establish lasting peace, stability and prosperity in our region. We previously hosted the direct negotiations between the conflicting parties. As before, we are ready to do our best and act as a mediator.
Erdogan arrived on the eve of the G20 summit in New Delhi. Therefore, the issue of the grain deal was also raised, from which Russia withdrew, since not a single promise given by the Western partners was fulfilled. Putin noted that the withdrawal of Russia does not affect the food crisis. In addition, Russia is ready to come up with several initiatives at once.
We intend to organize the supply of 1 million ton of grain from Russia at a preferential price for processing to Turkey and then free transportation to the poor countries. In this sense, we count on the help from the Qatari state, who is ready to support the poorest countries for humanitarian reasons.
According to the Russian leader, the initiative is not a replacement for the grain deal, but would make a great contribution to solving the food problem in the African countries. The visit by the Turkish president turned out to be quite short, just a few hours, and no documents were signed.
Turkey's hopes to extend the grain deal did not come true. However, Moscow and Ankara are already engaged in several joint projects. Russia is building the Akuyu nuclear power plant, and the state of the gas hub, which diversifies Russian gas supplies to Europe, also depends on Moscow. Russia is actively supporting Turkey in various sectors of the national economy, ranging from banking to metallurgy. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
tensions remain high in Sweden after the Holy Quran was desecrated in the city of Malmö on Sunday. A notorious Iraqi hate preacher has been attacking Islam's holy text on a routine basis for weeks. His antics led to an angry response as 15 people were arrested following confrontations with the police. Police provided protection for the offensive action and even arrested some Muslims who tried to save the Quran from the flames. Cities up and down Sweden are all being affected by these anti-Islam incidents. This mosque in central Stockholm has routinely been the victim of Quran desecration.